Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Today, I have the very special pleasure of being able to talk about one of my favorite movies of all time, The Princess Bride. Friendship, romance, and family are three central themes of this popular film. And in his book about it, today's guest examines the characters of the story, Wesley, Fezzik, Princess Buttercup, and many others, from a Buddhist perspective as he draws lessons from his own life and work as a meditation teacher. Our guest today is Ethan Nickturn, author of the book, The Dharma of the Princess Bride, What the Coolest Fairy Tale of Our Time Can Teach Us About Buddhism and Relationships. A renowned contemporary Buddhist teacher and the host of the Road Home podcast, Ethan has offered meditation and Buddhist psychology classes at conferences, meditation centers, yoga studios, and universities, including Brown, Yale, and New York University. He lives in Brooklyn, New York, and he was a guest on Pathways regarding one of his other books entitled Confidence. Well, hello, Ethan, and welcome back to the Pathways show.
Hey, Paul, it's really wonderful to be back with you. Thanks for having me again.
Well, it's so much fun for me to be able to talk to you about one of my three favorite movies. The other two, this is one that I've seen more than any other movie, not as much as you. The only other movies that I've seen five times or more are King of Hearts and Harold and Maude. So Princess Bride is in good company there, I think. But why don't we start out with, let's talk about the title of your book. What is the, for those who might not know, what does the word Dharma mean?
Yeah, Dharma, I mean, it's an Eastern word. It's a word primarily in Buddhism, but also it's a Sanskrit word. And it has multiple meanings, but it really means a body of teachings. So the Buddhist teachings are called the Dharma, but it can apply to any sort of body of knowledge, right? So you could say, like, if you're an architect, I studied the Dharma of architecture. If you're, a movie buff, the Dharma of filmmaking, etc. And my first book, I write about Buddhism and contemporary culture and psychology and things like that. So I remember my very first book, which was published by a small spiritual publisher. They had also published a book called The Dharma of Star Wars. It was an interesting book. It wasn't very memoir-y, but it was more kind of analyzing the Jedi code and the Force from a Buddhist standpoint. And I remember seeing that book and saying, if I ever do something like that, it's going to be about the Princess Bride.
Okay. And so the Dharma contained in the Princess Bride, the teaching, it's about friendship, it's about romance, and it's about family and basically relationships and our struggles with them, which you point out in the book are the crux of the spiritual path. In fact, I'm going to quote you. You say, sometimes I think that if we didn't have to deal with relationships, we would probably be enlightened already. That's a great quote. So these are the three themes of the movie. And I don't know that everybody who's listening to this has seen the movie, but that's okay. We don't have to reprise everything. And we can just assume that they have or that they will soon, I hope. But in any case, the Dharma of Friendship. So, you know, that's an interesting one. I'd say that's really from the point of view of Wesley, right? Or the Dread Pirate Roberts.
Yeah, I think it's from the point of view of Wesley. I mean, I think there's actually a small number of people who haven't seen The Princess Bride. It wasn't popular when it first came out. I was 9 years old when it first came out in 1987. Didn't do very well. Was based on the book, longer book by William Goldman, and but it grew in popularity as a cult classic over the years. And I think the website 538.com did a opinion poll of the most rewatchable movies of all time, and I think Princess Bride was number five or six on that list. So over the 40 years since it came out, it's become really popular. And you know, it's interesting because it's this really weird, wacky, between a grandfather and a grandson on a sick day home from school, telling of a fairy tale of a story that's part romance, Wesley or the Dread Pirate Roberts trying to reconnect with the love of his life, Buttercup. It's a story of vengeance and revenge. Mandy Patinkin's Inigo Montoya going with his friend Fezzik to try to take vengeance on the six-fingered man who killed his father. And it's a story of the love between a grandfather and a grandson. And I think what a lot of people love about it is it's a story of love and relationships that is so earnest and yet so tongue-in-cheek, hilariously kind of deconstructive of the fairy tale genre. And that combination of how heartfelt it is and at the same time how ridiculous it makes fairy tales look is kind of this beautiful balance that's very nearly impossible to achieve.
Yeah, no, it is so clever. And you, as you say in the book, The Princess Bride undermines the cheesy ideals of classic fairy tales while still fully celebrating true love. And the meta story of the relationship between the grandfather and the grandson, oh, that's just so, that's so rich. And the grandson, you know, anyway, one of the primary features of our cynical era is that we don't easily worship any idealistic version of romance anymore. And do you think that Princess Bride is something of an antidote for that?
Yeah, I think so in a way. I mean, I think it's very, you know, postmodern in a sense. There's not a lot of belief in the, I mean, people still watch rom-coms. So there is this sense of wanting true love and at the same time knowing the whole thing is kind of, I want to say something less cynical than farce, but is kind of a, it's not that easy. It's not going to happen, right? And in Buddhist terms, things fall apart. Things don't work out. We don't actually get what we want some of the time. And how do you actually work with that, you know? And how do you tell a story about that? And, you know, and part of the reason I wanted to work with this is I did want to write a Buddhist book about relationships because that's what I teach about. And that's the space that I work in and practice in. But I didn't want to frame it as being a relationship expert because I'm not, you know, and part of the premise of the book is there's no such thing as a relationship expert for the very simple reason that expert is one person and a relationship is always at least two people. So it's something you literally can't master on your own. You need to engage with others to even practice relationships. And so I wanted to find some way to talk about relationships that was personal. And, you know, this movie is personal to me because a family friend is in the movie. But that was personal, that was kind of a little bit memoir, but also acknowledge that something I think is really important, that our kind of spiritual understanding is usually based on the stories that we tell and the stories that we tell culturally at a given moment. And I think a story like The Princess Bride really does capture this combination of the cynicism or pessimism mixed with a kind of optimism of our era. And that's the way I think Buddhism is too. It's incredibly optimistic. And at the same time, it has this quality of saying, don't hold on to anything, right? Deconstruct,
you know,
everything.
I was very happy to see that this book exists because there, as a student of Buddhism for the last 50 years, I've seen very little that has shed light on the complexity of modern relationships. You know, in this era of insecure attachments, which I'm sure, you know, 2000 years ago, I mean, in the Tibetan culture, do they have insecure attachments? I don't even know if they understand what that concept means. But here, you know, we have all of this. It's just crazy. And we live forever. You know, back in the day when it was till death do us part, people were living to be 35. You know, it's like a different reality now. And it's very complex. And so I really appreciated that you are teaching or applying Buddhism to these, you know, seriously complicated relationship issues that we have these days that might not exist anywhere else or have not existed that much until now. And so you bring up this subject that you call the theism of romance, and I found that fascinating. Can you unpack that?
So my parents' Buddhist teacher, Chogyam Trungpa, who was one of the pioneers of Buddhism in the Western world and Tibetan Buddhism more specifically, he talked about Buddhism as a non-theistic tradition. And he that was the specific framing that he used. And he didn't use the term atheistic. He distinguished it from that. Because what he viewed theism more as kind of an approach to feeling spiritually secure. And the way he viewed theism was this notion of there's a savior, something or someone is coming to save us. And a theistic approach is this notion of if I kind of give up my power or if I to something else, then I will be okay. Right? I won't have to do any work. I won't have to be present. And so the way he defined non-theism is the realization it doesn't have the same thing to do as a belief in God. I think you can be non-theistic in his definition and completely believe in God. But the idea is nothing external is coming to save you from yourself, from working with your own heart, from working with your own mind. And that view that I think is the view that we often fall into when we're trying to find genuine love and connection is this idea that if I find the right person, I will be saved from having to be alone with myself, you know? And the non-theistic approach is you always have to deal with being alone with yourself, right? You're not, nobody's going to save you from that.
And these days, all too often, when a relationship, when two people part ways, the typical thing you hear is, "Well, it was just the wrong person for me," as if there's this one savior for you out there if you can find the right one.
Right. And you know, there is compatibility, there is connection, but the idea that you're going to find that one, you know, which I think the idea of Princess Buttercup, it's such a good name in a sense for that idealization. You know, it's Robin Wright. She was gorgeous, so it fits all those like fairy tale tropes of like if you can just find your perfect princess. You know, I have a 7-year-old daughter, and you know, she likes a lot of different things, but she likes all the Disney princesses. And it is interesting, like all of those narratives of the perfect princess and the perfect prince charming, they do survive in our culture. And this movie, I think, undercuts that by saying it's not actually, I mean, it looks that way, but it's not that way.
So what would you say that this movie has to teach us about true love?
Yeah. I mean, we don't know how it ends up with Cary Elwes and with Wesley and Robin Wright with Princess Buttercup, because the movie ends with them just getting together. I think the two relationships in the movie that really embody true love the most are the grandfather and grandson. And that's one of the reasons I think I grew very nostalgic with this movie is Fred Savage is the grandson somewhere in suburban Chicago. And he was about my age that I was when I first watched the movie. I was 9 years old. My grandfather died that year, committed suicide actually. But there's true love there, right? There's this phrase of devotion that Wesley says throughout the movie to Buttercup, as you wish, right? Which is his sort of, I'm devoted to you, I'm committed to you. And the grandfather says that to the grandson at the end of the movie, right? Which kind of nails, like, this movie was actually about that. It was about the transmission of love through storytelling, through this wacky storytelling from the grandfather to the grandson. The other relationship that I think embodies true love in the movie is a minor one. It's Billy Crystal and Carol Kane, Miracle Max, who they go to try to bring Wesley back to life when he's been tortured by the six-fingered man, who is also my father's best friend. So that's my family connection to this movie. And his very wacky, he's very wacky, and his wife is very wacky, Valerie, Carol Kane. And they have clearly been together forever, and they fight with each other, but they love each other and they know each other. And it's a very brief interaction, but you get the sense that that's actually what love becomes when a relationship is successful, is two people who know each other's eccentricities and are actually supporting each other and telling each other the truth, you know. And so I think those are, we don't know how it turns out with Wesley and Buttercup, but those two relationships, the grandfather and the grandson, and Miracle Max and Valerie, really actually do embody something about true love to me.
Yeah, it was beautiful the way the grandfather says at the end, as you wish. Which was the thing that Wesley always, the farm boy in the beginning, would always reply to Buttercup whenever she'd make some demand on him, no matter how ridiculous. He would say, as you wish, and that's all he would ever say. Now, I'm wondering, do you think that that's a good dating strategy for men?
Depends on the man, I think. I think in general it's a good thing for men to practice, because if we're talking about heterosexual, you know, cisgendered men, in the sense of you know, I think As You Wish represents the kind of devotion. I think in Buddhist terms, it really represents this sense of I'm letting go. You know, I'm letting go of my ego in this moment to be of service to you. And I do think it's a good thing to practice. I mean, I think a healthy relationship that is practiced in balance. But I think in a larger sense in our world, you know, especially with patriarchy, though we're out of balance. So it could be, you know, it could be nice. It might be nice politically at this moment for husbands to say to their wives, if you're voting that way, as you wish, I will, you know.
I would support that, especially this
Yeah,
year. Oh
of
man.
course.
So on the theme of friendship, you know, you point to Fezzik as an example of a good friend. And you talk about how people can befriend themselves, and you say that accepting your own friend request is there's a word for that, meditation. So tell us what you mean by that and what you mean by awakened friendship.
Yeah, that was coming from the book I wrote before this, The Road Home, which was really written at the height of the Facebook era. You know, I guess we don't, on other platforms, you follow people, you don't necessarily accept their friend requests. But that was, you know, on Facebook, that sense of like getting a friend request from somebody, a little light would light up, and it's like, oh, this person wants to connect with me, right? And so the way I thought about that is meditation. Chogyam Trungpa said the purpose of meditation is to make friends with yourself, which I love that. Like, we don't actually spend a lot of time with ourselves. I mean, we often spend time alone, but we're usually doing something, right? We might be reading or gardening, where we're bouncing our mind off of kind of external objects, you know, which can be really, really healthy. But in meditation, you're really looking at your heart and your mind in the present moment, and you're seeing what it does. And you're, you know, learning how to tolerate yourself. You're kind of learning how to appreciate the thoughts, the emotions, the sensations that happen in silence. And it is, I think, an act of friendship. So I like that notion
Yeah,
of
no.
a friend request, you
I
know.
thought it was beautiful. Let's talk about longing for a second, because you used the term longing in a kind of positive way. And I
Yeah.
made me wonder, as somebody who has studied Buddhism for a long time, isn't longing a form of craving?
It's a good question, and that's exactly why I use that word. In the form of Buddhism that I practice, which is Tantric or Vajrayana Buddhism, which is the form that really flourished in Tibet and the Himalayan region before spreading to the West and throughout the world, no particular emotion is a problem, right? Our emotions can manifest as confused tendencies, as blockages. They can cause harm, right? And Buddhism definitely points to, and we can see it everywhere. We can see it through our addictions, our addictive behaviors, our addiction to consumerism, that sense of how desire can turn into this fixated need where we become kind of puppets to our desires. And that, I think, is the problematic form of desire. But I also think desire has a wisdom, a wise aspect. And it's really when you feel into your heart like what desire is, especially when it's desire to connect with other people. There's a quality of it that is completely heartfelt, completely human, and completely awake. And so the word longing really captures that kind of innocent and wise side
I think
of
it's great.
desire to me.
I think it's great that you clarify that, because a lot of people think that dukkha means desire, and that dukkha is the cause of is suffering that's caused by desire. But it's not. Desire is a too broad a word for that. I mean, if you didn't have desire, you wouldn't do anything. You wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. You wouldn't, strive for enlightenment. You wouldn't do noble acts. You wouldn't do anything. So desire is a
Yeah.
good thing, but it's like when it, like you said, when it gets attached to this emotional demandingness. So let's talk about, though, one of the manifestations of desire, which is dating. And I love what you said in the book, and I'm going to quote you: "Dating, my own master of brutality, the one who forced me to work with my fear of annihilation, was not a person but an activity. My own brutal guru was dating."
Yeah.
That's a really good way of summing it up, what's going on these days.
Yeah, I was talking to a particular period in my life that I was equating to Wesley being the Dread Pirate Roberts on the high seas, and his experience of training from the previous Dread Pirate Roberts, where he never knew if he was going to live another day. And there is this quality that I think a lot of people struggle with it. That period of life happened before all of the dating apps that folks struggle with now. And in a sense, it's a more, I think all of our technology just intensifies a lot of the same spiritual and psychological themes that humans always work with. But that basic premise of trying to figure out if another human being likes you, if you like them, how do you do that? How do you do that in a healthy way? How do you connect with them? How do you acknowledge difference? How do you not be aggressive towards yourself or others in doing that? How do you be authentic and genuine and vulnerable? And really putting yourself out there. It's a profound spiritual practice, I would say. Just like marriage was for me, just like becoming a father was. But I think that particular practice, as I, look back on my life, of like showing up and being like, "Hey, do you want to do something sometime?" And then like actually moving through that dance in a way that, felt authentic and compassionate. It was brutal, and I talked to a lot of people who also find it brutal. And what a lot of people say about, even now that there are dating apps and you can find people more easily, I think dating apps are interesting because you can it kind of solves the problem of figuring out if somebody is initially interested in you, which I think is very compassionate. That you don't have to sort of like play so many guessing games to figure out if somebody wants to like hang out with you that initial time. but it also presents this sense of just like what I call it in the book, like hungry ghosts, you know, which is a Buddhist phrase of just beings wandering, looking for fulfillment and not being able to satiate themselves and not feeling particularly good about themselves. And and so, you know, I think it's really important to be compassionate and kind with oneself and others if that's the phase of life we're in.
You know, that's beautifully put. And there's so much more we could talk about, but we're running out of time. And I just wanted to point out that you describe Chogyam Trungpa's optimistic view as basic goodness being the true nature of humanity. And then you end the book by saying, the movie reconnects me fully to basic goodness. And that's the exact same feeling that I got from it. And I think that a lot of people got from it. And I really want to recommend that people read your books, The Dharma of the Princess Bride, as well as Confidence and several of the books that you've written. I really appreciate all the work you do. And I wish we could take more time today, Ethan. But thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is ethannickturn.com. It's all one word, ethannickturn.com. And for those who may have tuned into Pathways late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Intuitive Intelligence, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. Now, don't worry, you can play and or share this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast, and I'll tell you how in a minute. Today, we've been visiting with Ethan Nickturn, author of The Dharma of the Princess Bride, with the coolest fairy tale of our time, can teach us about Buddhism and relationships. And I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed on the internet at www.kboo.fm every Sunday morning at 8:30 USA Pacific time. And even better, podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, that's spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes, Paulo's YouTube channel, and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien, reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcasts. And thanks again to Ethan Nickturn and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways conversation.